All right, McConnell, 10:09. First guest of the day stands by. Once in a while, one of these child-rearing books comes across the desk, kind of grabs your eye, sometimes for better, sometimes for worse. This one's called It's Okay Not to Share. The idea was to grab the attention of someone like me or you, and it does. It has to do with a way of raising kids that, in fact, the author went through herself, one particular school, SYU, forget what it's called, but I'll find out because the guest stands by. She would be Heather Shoemaker. Good to have you, Heather. How are you?
Good morning. Good to be here.
Name of the school outside Columbus, Ohio was School for what?
School for Young Children.
SYC, School for Young Children, which kind of sums up a name for a preschool. It's a school for young children.
That's right. And the emphasis is on remembering it's for the children.
Not to treat them like adults necessarily out of the gate. Which kind of flies in the face of something, one of the things that I just kind of did myself. And that was, I always talked to, in my case, my daughter, like she was just a little bit older than she actually was.
And did that work for you?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah?
They tended to pay attention more, think like they're one of the family as opposed to the rabbit or the dog or something.
Yeah, talking to rabbits doesn't generally work too well.
No. So you went through this, you were raised that way, and then I guess you had kids of your own, you went back to, you looked for preschools that I guess handled things the way you were raised, didn't find any, went back and did the story pretty much based on the way kids are taught, I won't say raised, but are taught at that school. Fair to say?
Fair to say, because when I went and looked at other preschools, they had changed so much. Most of them are a lot of academic, sit down, be quiet, and learn your ABCs. And the toys were growing dusty in classrooms that I visited.
Now, the point you make, and I agree with this entirely, kids need to play. There's a lot of learning that goes on through playing, a lot of social interaction that you learn more about by playing.
Exactly. And in fact, some of the play that parents often squelch, which is rough play and active play, we're discovering through brain research that roughhousing and puppy playing, wrestling with each other, actually helps develop the part of the brain that helps with academic learning later on. So sometimes the learning that takes place is obvious, and sometimes it's sort of in disguise.
Did you say that at that school they'll occasionally even put boxing gloves on little three-year-olds and let them have at it?
Well, they put the boxing gloves out and give them tumbling mats, and the kids have boxing games. They have wrestling matches, and they even set up their own rules. So if the teachers spot kids rolling together on the floor, they don't say, get your hands off each other, get back in your chair. Instead, they'll say, looks like you two want to wrestle. Let's move that game over to the wrestling mat. And it's neat to watch what happens because they'll say, do you want to make up any rules? And usually the kids will say no at first. And after somebody gets maybe their hair pulled or something happens, they will say, hey, I don't like that. Don't do that. And they'll start to make the rules together, and they negotiate what they like and what they don't like peer-to-peer.
You also say it's okay, and this kind of goes back to the time, not to share even your time with friends. Let a kid pick the kids that he wants to play with, even if somebody gets shut out, which flies in the face of people today would call that bullying. If there's one kid nobody wanted to play with, that's the last thing in the world you could possibly let happen. And yet you say it's good.
Well, it does scare people. Social rejection scares us because we've all felt it ourselves, and we want to spare that pain for our kids. But, you know, there are ways to reject somebody respectfully instead of so it doesn't turn into bullying. You can say, I don't want to play right now, and still be able to play with the one chosen friend or even play by yourself. There's no reason kids should be forced into friendships or forced to accept another child in. But
so the kid says, I don't want to play with you ever. Get off my property. What's the answer to that one?
Well, you can help them say something. You know, we need to treat people respectfully, even if we're not going to be friends with them. It doesn't give us license to be cruel or mean to other people. But, you know, rejection is part of life skills, too. And one thing that kids need to learn is to be able to take those social risks, to realize that somebody might say yes, they might say no, to have the courage to still take that risk, and to realize that they can recover and cope from rejection.
One of the things you stand for and I agree with is not to try to get a kid to read and work with flashcards when he's, you know, 3 and 4 years old. There are some parents that think it's going to give the kid a leg up getting into Harvard, and it really doesn't.
No, what we're finding is that play-based preschools and play-based homes kids are getting more of what they need for later schooling than kids who are rushed into early academics. In fact, psychologists are calling this the age of 7 plus or minus 1, which means around age 7, that's when kids' brains change enough that they're really ready for academics. And if you have an early learner who likes to read at age 3, let them go. But if you don't, let them play.
Well, let them go for a while, then kick them outside to play.
Exactly. If they're going to read, have them read up in a tree.
That makes sense. Now to some areas of disagreement. If your kid is hitting you or kicking you or telling you they hate you, I'm not supposed to take that personally.
Well, for hitting and kicking, I have a chapter called Let Kids Hit and Kick. Now, this is not hitting and kicking a person. They might try to hit and kick you. They might actually succeed. But you need to redirect that and say, if you need to hit, you can hit the sofa. So give them an outlet, a safe substitute target for their hitting energy.
They don't hate the sofa. They hate you temporarily.
Exactly. They do temporarily. And you can say, oh, you are really mad right now. You're so mad you want to hit me. I can't let you hit me, but you can hit the sofa. Get your anger out on the sofa or on a pillow or on a tree. And for I hate you, which is something parents do here, it's to get to the feeling underneath it. You are so mad right now. You're so mad at me that you're saying I hate you. But to be able to realize they're probably saying that because you set a good parenting limit, and it's just a child who's temporarily very, very angry at you. You don't have to take it as a lifelong idea of what your future relationship is going to be.
I saw a family in a park one day, and the kid was acting kind of bratty, and the father picked him up. And there was a low-hanging branch where the father picked him up. And the kid's kicking and yelling and all that, and he reaches up and grabs the branch and starts smacking his father in the head with it.
Oy.
And dad's response was, we don't hit. I thought, man, that would never be my response. We don't hit. Kid's hitting me in the head with a branch, and he's about probably, I don't know, 6 years old. What's your response to that one?
Well, I've seen parents be hit, not with a branch, by their kids and do nothing about it, maybe besides saying it's not nice to hit. We have to be stronger than that.
Yep.
Sometimes we have to physically restrain our child. We have to be strong enough to say, people are not for hitting. I'm not going to let you hit me. If you need to hit, hit something else, and hold their arms if you need to, because we have to draw the line on not being a target ourselves.
If he held this kid's arms, the kid would have bit him. There was no ending this.
Well, it sounds like a bad situation.
I mean, you're a parent yourself, and you'd have to agree. A lot of this seems, you know, nice and tidy in book form, but when you get out into reality, there are extenuating circumstances, right?
There are always surprises in parenting. But I think if you have the tools at your command that can help out in many cases when a child is angry or out of control, or just active. Maybe they're playful and happy, but they have a lot of energy. If you have some tools and ideas to work with, it makes it a lot easier.
So you don't believe in the because I said so, which always worked well with me, especially with, like, other people's kids. You know, some other kid's at your house, and he's doing something in your house you're not supposed to, and you tell him, yeah, you got to knock that off, and they say, why, or says who? My answer is, because I said so. I said it, and it stops. It works. What's wrong with that? It works.
You demonstrated setting a limit, and parents, whether they're you're parenting someone else's child or your own child, adults need to be able to set limits and be comfortable where they drew the line. The exact wording doesn't necessarily matter, but as long as you're setting a clear limit, it'll work.
I was glad to see that you don't think a kid should be allowed to dance on the dining room table during dinner.
I don't think I had a particular dancing chapter, but yes. I remember a family who had their daughter.
The one who eats under the table was another one, yes.
As a dog in the middle of the table.
And that's okay. If your kid wants to eat on the floor like a dog.
If that's okay in your own family, that's one thing. In our family, we have rules for dinner, and that would be something you can do. You can be a dog when it's not dinner time. You can be a dog here, but not right now. Sometimes all we need to do is change the timing or the location. So the idea might be great, but not necessarily the timing or the location that the child chooses. And then we just need to find a substitute time or location for that idea to happen.
All right, is there any such thing as there being one way to raise kids? Everyone has a different personality, and I'm sure your book would work well for a good percentage of people. For others, with a kid with a completely different personality. I mean, my point is, I don't think there's any one way to raise kids. Gee, your kids turned out great. What did you do right? Well, who knows? Sometimes you just get lucky and have a kid who's no trouble.
What's great about this book is it's a compilation of experience from about 75 early childhood educators from this preschool who over 40 years have worked with all kinds of personalities, boys, girls, active, not, challenging, easy. And so combining the wisdom of all those people over four decades and combining it with other ideas and research gives a lot of tools for almost any personality. Sure, there's no one way to raise a child, but here's some ideas that can help.
All right, do you have a website specific to your book, It's Okay Not to Share?
Yes, and the website is heathershoemaker.com.
S-H-U-M-A-K-E-R, and we'll have a link on our website to you. How about that?
That sounds fantastic.
All right, Heather, I hope you have some great kids.
All right, thank you, Mike.
All right, thanks very much.
No.
Almost 24 after 10 o'clock. Where's my new schedule? Talk among yourselves. Hey, Michael Cohen, is he with the Daily Beast? Is that where he is? Yes. Daily News, I'm sorry, on Ryan as a terrible choice here at 10:35 this morning. And we've still pending David Axelrod. We'll see. And then at some point we'll get somebody on who thinks Ryan is a marvelous choice. We'll see. Just throwing back to the previous subject quickly, this two articles I've read recently, and I think both were in the New York Times, or one or the other was, where along the lines of kids, you know, growing up, that it's okay for kids to be both a boy and a girl. And this is supposedly a growing trend referred to as gender fluid. Your son or daughter may be gender fluid. And, you know, they talk about this kid who decided it was time to go to school. Well, he's of the age to go to school, and he decided he wanted to go dressed as a girl. Well, you know, maybe he likes to put on a dress at home, but bullying has not gone away. And how you have, you know, a parent can think that it's going to be fine in this supposed tolerant world full of six-year-olds, that your kid can go, your boy can go to school dressed as a girl because, after all, he decided he was gender fluid. Whatever that means, it's a new term on me. You know, a new term created by somebody who couldn't say no. And we do have, you know, X percentage of parents who just can't say no. Well, I'm gender fluid. Oh, well, sure. But it didn't mention he had sisters. It's not like he put on a sister's dress. At some point, as you're reading the article, you get the impression at some point his parents went and bought him a dress. Well, that's a place you could draw the line, isn't it? We shop in the boys' department. Why? Because you're a boy. But then the whole idea that you'd let your kid go to kindergarten dressed as a girl, what are people thinking? How accepting do you think the world is? You know, it doesn't matter what group of six-year-olds or five-year-olds you're dealing with, there's going to be a percentage who understands that that's strange. And in part because we have decided as a society that it's strange. I saw a guy yesterday in a skirt, a very nice pleated skirt. I'm an open-minded guy. He was my age. I still thought it was strange. I thought, why would you walk through downtown Chicago in a skirt?
That's a kilt, my friend.
No, I know a kilt when I see one. I'm fully aware of what a kilt looks like. And although it was pleated, it was not a kilt. The man was wearing a skirt. And I'm not saying it looked bad on him. And at his age, people are less likely to pick on him than when you go to kindergarten. But you're really setting a kid up for a rough childhood by giving into him at times like that. So keep your eye peeled for gender fluid. The new term is gender fluid. So when we get to following news here, by the way, Steve, did you go anywhere on your vacation? You were gone for a week. Did you do anything fun?
You know, went up to Traverse City for a few days.
That's fun.
Very fun. And then came back and hung out with my son. He was trying out for soccer.
Did you bring us some cherries?
I did not. Okay. They were gone by then.
It's all right.
Sorry.
It's always next year. Thank you. All right, Mike McConnell, 23 away from 11. All right, a little politics stuff here over the weekend. Of course, big news was Mitt Romney had settled on his VP running mate, Paul Ryan of Wisconsin. And we begin the fallout from that. Those who think it's a dandy idea, those who think it's a horrific idea. And one headline that grabbed my attention was why Ryan is simply a terrible choice. Michael Cohen puts this together. And Michael Cohen's fellow at the Century Foundation Let's see, I had a book back in 08, Live from the Campaign Trail, having to do mainly with speeches delivered on the campaign trail. But having the program here, good to talk to you. How you doing there, Michael Cohen?
Good. Good to be here.
Yeah. From this, you're saying he would be a terrible choice. From which perspective? I would think if you are Democrat and you think he's a terrible choice, that would make him a great choice.
Well, I mean, from my perspective, for Democrats, I mean, they're probably giddy over this choice because it really does play into their key attack line against Romney, which is that he basically favors the wealthy, that he would do great damage to the social safety net, to Medicare. He opens up all sorts of lines of attack that Obama was already utilizing. So from that perspective, I think it's great for Democrats. And also, in an odd way, it undercuts, you know, one of Romney's key arguments that Obama lacks the experience and is sort of, you know, over his head with the job. He picked somebody who basically spent most of his career in Washington and has been a congressman most of his life. So in a lot of ways, it helps him among, obviously, conservative voters, but they're not the ones who are going to decide this election. And among the other non-conservative voters, I'm not sure how it helps Romney very much.
What selection would have been somehow the stopper to suggest, okay, Romney's not just out for the rich, he is for the middle class? I think pretty much anybody he picked would have not gotten that job done.
Yeah, I mean, I think someone like Pawlenty or Portman, even McDonnell in Virginia, I mean, these are sort of safe picks. They're not terribly exciting picks, but they don't sort of create, they don't put a target on your back the way that Ryan does. And in a way, if you pick someone like Pawlenty, then you can kind of run as outsiders, which is a little trickier to do with someone like Ryan on the ticket. The problem, it seems, with Ryan is that I think the big thing to think about with a VP pick is do no harm, right? Pick somebody who's not going to hurt you. Ryan has the potential to really hurt Romney and to play up, his negatives.
I think the one difference I see with Ryan is that he does a pretty good job of explaining his positions and his stances without getting in somebody's face. He's able to smile and convince you that, well, some of this does make sense.
Sure. I mean, I think he's an effective salesman, but the problem is what he's selling is not very popular, right? So, I mean, he's selling a program that would basically get rid of Medicare as we know it and a program that would cut taxes on the wealthy, which has been a problem for Romney. I mean, a plan that would basically cut Romney's taxes to below 1%. So, I agree he's good, has a good public presentation, but people said that about Sarah Palin, too, and she didn't work out so well.
Well, we didn't really know anything about Sarah Palin until about, 2 weeks into it. Well, Ryan's been, he's been tested. I mean, he's certainly for years done the Sunday morning shows, and he handles his press conferences, and we kind of know what he's about. She was the great unknown.
That's true. And the thing with Ryan, though, is that he has only run for congressman. He's never been on the national stage, which is very different than running for a district of 700,000 people in Wisconsin.
Jumping
in is Steve Bertrand.
I'm sorry to interrupt, but I think most people, whether they like it or not, they realize we need some bad medicine, and he delivers the bad medicine pretty well.
I'm not sure I'd agree with that, actually. I don't think many people think that we should turn Medicare into a voucher system. In fact, if you look at the polling on a lot of Ryan's proposals, they're very, very unpopular. The Medicare proposal is deeply unpopular. So I'm not so sure that I think this bad medicine argument gets overstated. I think a lot of Americans, when they realize what that means, having to pay more for health care, having fewer Medicare benefits, seeing the safety net being, basically destroyed, I don't think they're going to be very supportive of that. Americans love the idea of, hate the idea of big government in the abstract, but they love the specifics of it.
They're not going to like it because it polls like it's bad medicine. The guy just got to convince us that we need it.
Well, I guess, yeah, I see that as an upside. I'm agreeing with Steve on this one, in that somebody has to drive home the point that Medicare, as we know it, can't last forever. Something has to be done. Now, maybe his answer isn't the answer, but putting the spotlight on what are certainly serious future problems for the United States it can't be a negative, I don't think.
I don't think his solution is much of a solution, because it's not. I mean, what he would do is basically get rid of Medicare as we know it. That's not a popular proposal, and it's not even a good proposal for older Americans. It actually would do great damage to them. The thing is that his proposal would basically balance the budget, and it wouldn't even balance the budget. He says it would, but it really wouldn't. But it would do it on the backs of middle class and poor people. It would cut taxes for the wealthy. These aren't popular proposals, and I don't think they're even good proposals from a fiscal standpoint.
Explain to me how it would cut Romney's tax rate down below 1%.
Basically, the problem with Ryan's plan is that it cuts taxes for the wealthiest Americans. And for Romney, who would fall into that category, especially, I think, from capital gains cuts, because there's a big capital gains cut in Ryan's budget, would reduce Romney's tax burden to less than, I think it's something like 0.82% he'd pay on his tax.
Well, he wants to cut it from 15 to what?
I believe he wants to eliminate it, but don't quote me on that.
I have seen calls to eliminate it, which I guess that does not make sense to me. But the idea that it could be, if in fact it generates more trades and therefore more revenue at 10% than 15, I mean, if it generates fewer trades and less revenue by hiking it to 25, it doesn't make much sense to raise it to 25 either. There are arguments in either direction.
Right, but we're talking about bad medicine, right? So it seems that Ryan's bad medicine plan is to basically force the elderly to pay more for health care. It's to force the poor to do less with social services and to give the wealthy a big tax break. I don't mean to sound like a partisan here, but that's basically what the plan would do. It would take from the poor and give to the wealthy. So in a sense, it's kind of not right to call it bad medicine because in a way it's just bad policy that ironically ends up favoring the wealthy more than the rest of the American people.
Yeah, from what I understand, the idea behind the Medicare plan is to go to a voucher-type system, which would then force the Medicare recipient, which in 10 years could be me, to force the Medicare recipient to shop around, which then, in theory, causes competition and the price to go down, the cost of overall medical care to go down. In theory, I think it makes sense. Now, I might not like it if I've been comfortably on Medicare as we have it today for 4 or 5 years, but from a fiscal perspective, long term, it does make some sense.
Well, I mean, Medicare is a fairly efficient, you know, program, and it's actually a really popular program. And it's interesting, by the way, to see Republicans attacking Obama on this point, basically accusing him of cutting Medicare, when in fact he reduced Medicare spending by $700 billion in Obamacare, and now they're attacking him for it. It's sort of an interesting element here that they like Medicare cuts. You know, they don't like Medicare cuts when Obama proposes them, but they're more than happy to propose them in their own budget.
Well, and I guess that's one thing that's refreshing to me about Ryan, is he says what he says at great political risk to himself. For Democrats and Republicans, their primary job is to remain in charge and hold their offices and not to do what's in the best interest of the country. What I see refreshing about Ryan is, even, and that's why Republicans oppose him, because what he says isn't in the best interest of them keeping their jobs. But when I look toward the best interest of the country and not just the partisanship of Democrat versus Republican, I like people who say the sorts of things Ryan's willing to say.
I mean, I'll say this. I think it's great that he's the VP nominee in the sense that Americans have a clear choice, right? There's no ambiguity about what they're facing in November.
Right.
If they vote for a Republican ticket, they're basically voting for the Ryan budget, and they'll have a chance.
Well, Romney has his own budget. The vice president rarely steps into his position and begins to get his way on budgetary issues. I mean, he has a plan, but at some point, whatever budget came out in the future would be a mixed bag of Democrat and Republican. It would be a bipartisan plan, ultimately.
I think Romney has said he would sign the Ryan budget, and I imagine if Romney were to win and Republicans took over control of the Senate, my guess is they would try to push a lot of the Ryan budget through reconciliation, which doesn't need 60 votes.
Yeah, well, when asked last night on 60 Minutes about Ryan's budget, Romney was quick to say, of course, I have my own budget.
He did say that. He's also said he would sign the Ryan budget, but he hasn't. I mean, he said he has his own budget, but you know, he hasn't actually put that forward, which makes sense. He's still running for president, but a lot of what he's proposing would reduce taxes. This is, you know, this is a key argument that's come out recently that he would reduce his own taxes if his tax plan went into effect. But here's the thing, you know, the Ryan pick to me, what it suggests is that the Tea Party and certainly the conservative wing of the party has a disproportionate policy role in the Republican Party right now. And so I think that if Romney were to win, it'd be very hard for him to resist the calls from Congress to pass some version of the Ryan budget. And I think, you know, you have to judge, you know, Romney on who he selected and what he said. And I think it's fair to say that if he's elected, you'll see some variation of the Ryan budget. Maybe not the exact Ryan budget, but some variation of that. And that gives Americans a very clear choice as to who to choose, who to vote for in November.
Yeah, not that it carries a lot of weight in my mind, but much has been said so far about the different or how it would appear in a Ryan versus Biden debate. Now, we really don't make up our minds based on vice presidential debates, but Ryan certainly, I think, again, he's an excellent salesman. He makes his points well. Biden, I think, tends to put his foot in his mouth fairly often. Again, not a deal breaker, but it's just one of those that will be interesting to watch.
Well, I mean, he can be a gaffe machine, but he was pretty good in the VP debate in 2008 against Palin. I imagine he'll do fine against Ryan. I imagine Ryan will do fine also. I think as salesmen, they're both politicians and politicians for most of their lives. I'm sure they'll do fine. I think it's more a question of what they're selling and how popular that's going to be.
From the Democrat perspective, the Axelrod perspective, who do you think he would have liked to have seen? Is Ryan about the best he could have dreamed of?
Or? Yes. I think Paul Ryan's the person they dreamed of.
All right. Well, we might talk to David Axelrod before the end of the program. We'll find out. But
I'd be curious if he agrees with that. Maybe he wouldn't say. I don't know.
Yeah, well, we'll find out. Listen, Michael Cohen, I appreciate your time. We can follow you on Twitter at SpeechBoy71, correct?
That's right.
A fellow at the Century Foundation, and the book back in 08 was Life on the Campaign Trail. So maybe we'll touch base again. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Take care.
Isn't it cool, Mike, that we're talking about a choice not by what state they're from? Or what they look like.
Yeah, that's another one, yeah.
Yeah, it's exciting to me.
Not a swing state, so it wasn't a necessary pick from that regard.
Right, exactly. And so it's finally about whether you like the issue or not, this campaign might actually be about something.
And the one thing about the number, I haven't seen Ryan more than a half a dozen times, I guess, but I really, and maybe it's because of my line of work, I appreciate someone who answers questions. And he does give pretty direct answers to direct questions. That may change as a vice presidential nominee.
Right. It's easy to do that from Janesville.
Right. But he is a straight shooter. You know, he doesn't seem to duck it. I mean, his first duck last night was when he was asked how many years of his tax returns he put out there, and he said two. You know, same as he can't overdo Romney. He can't go with five if Romney has two.
You know, Pawlenty was asked that. I don't know if that was this morning or yesterday. And he said, well, they asked for several. But he wouldn't go. He wouldn't say more than two either.
Yeah, well, that's what Ryan's willing to put out, or already has. But Paul Ryan is 42 years old, so I was curious. Took a look at the youngest vice presidents in U.S. history. Steve Bertrand, I will give you an A for the day if you can tell me whose vice president John C. Breckinridge was. I'll admit I had to look it up. I didn't know he was vice president at 36 years old.
John C. Breckinridge.
I see you typing.
No, I am not.
Google crazy.
No. I'm going to go with Teddy Roosevelt.
James Buchanan. Roosevelt himself was pretty. He was 42 when he was vice president. Nixon was 40. He never looked 40 to me. Richard Nixon always looked like he was over 60. I don't care how old he was, but under Eisenhower, he was 40 years old. Dan Quayle at 41. John Calhoun at 42. But John C. Breckinridge did not come to mind for me at all. Buchanan. David, go ahead. You're on WGN. What's up?
Quick question. How does Ryan duck the question on tax returns if he says that he's going to release 2 years? That's a direct answer.
How does he duck what question?
Because you said the only question he ducked was the one on tax returns, and then you said he would release only 2 years.
The point I was making was he seems like somebody who directly answers questions without going political. And that was the first example of him going political, was that he only released as many tax years as Romney.
Yeah, I don't interpret it that way. He's just saying, I'm going to do 2 years. It would be political if he said, well, I'm going to consult with the campaign and get back to you later.
No, I'm sure he already consulted with the campaign, and that's why he's releasing 2 years.
I bet you $50, I'll bet you $100 that he released more than two to the campaign.
Sure.
Right. But it just didn't seem like it was a duck or a political answer, the way you phrased it was, because to me, a ducking or a political is when you don't give a direct answer to a direct question.
Well, it was a political fudge on a decision that came out of the answer, put it that way. The 2 years, obviously, is because I'm sure it was discussed at great length, or he was simply told, 2 years, and that's it.
I'm with you. I just hate it when they don't answer a question, and they, you know, you get you're asked a question on the environment, and you talk about, tax or something other than what the question was.
Which happens all the time. But up to this point, he's been that kind of a guy. Now, I have to say, the last person I said I appreciated because he always answered questions was Dick Cheney. And then once he became vice president, he was a whole different animal. But up until then, you know, Sunday morning shows or whatever, it didn't matter how popular it sounded. He gave you a direct answer to a direct question.
I think Biden does that, too.
I forget if he's answering the question because he gets so long-winded.
Right. But he's more than most, I think he does gets there, and then he gets in trouble for it.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, it's just kind of wish you would think about it before he answered the question sometimes, because that's when his foot gets in his mouth.
Right, the answer wouldn't be as good.
I think that Sunday morning shows had Biden on whenever the host thought he was coming down with laryngitis, because he asked Biden a question, just give him 5 minutes. He just keeps going.
So. All right, great. Thanks for taking the call, Mike.
Thanks, you bet. Have a good day. And Irene, how are you? Irene, are you there? Do you read me? No, Irene? Irene went away. So anyway, back to the Ryan thing on both the Medicare, and David Cohen's column was saying that he believes that Ryan's idea, not that it was his idea, to allow younger people to opt out of Social Security was the beginning of the end for the Bush administration. And it wasn't. The war in Iraq was both, it was that ultimately led to the unraveling of Bush's popularity, and of course his administration ran its course.
And then the market started tanking.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to put your faith in something that's not, if you've got something that's quasi-guaranteed, and then the market starts to go down, that hurts.
Well, yeah, the housing market tanked, and the market tanked.
But my thing about the bad medicine is there are going to be a lot of us who are going to have to be, we will have to be angry and upset if it's going to work. It's just going to, that's the way it's going to have to be. Right? There's no plan out there that's going to make everyone happy.
No.
And that's what I like about at least Ryan is putting one out there that he's willing to make a lot of people unhappy about.
Like I said, yeah, it's great political risk for him, and now it's political risk for Romney to have him, you know, on the ticket. But these are things that have to be said, and not just by, you know, radio hosts and other pundits. They have to be said by somebody who's in a position to affect change.
Or blue ribbon
committees. Yeah, yeah. And they'll all make the same point. I mean, you have to expand the tax base. You can't just count on nailing, you know, one group of people. I've always been a firm believer that if you live in this country and you enjoy the benefits of it, then everybody should have some money in the kitty. It's just that simple. I don't see it as an oversimplification either.